Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson. Robin is off today. It's Here and Now, and happy 4th of July from all of us. And it's a holiday here in the U.S., but in the U.K. today, more fallout from the decision to leave the European Union. The head of the U.K. Independence Party, Nigel Farage, resigned from that leadership post today.
During the referendum campaign, I said, I want my country back. And what I'm saying today is I want my life back. And it begins right now. Thank you.
Farage was one of the leading voices in the Leave campaign. And as Britain prepares to leave, other countries are still hoping to join the EU, including Turkey. Joining us now from Istanbul is the BBC's Selin Girit. And Selin, where does Turkey's bid stand?
Well, Turkey has been waiting on the doorstep of the European Union for decades now, actually. It has been a candidate country for membership since 1999, and the accession negotiations started 11 years ago. But when we're talking about the bid for European Union accession, it's been a journey of over 40 years for Turkey, and not much has been achieved, unfortunately, for Ankara. Recently, though, the European Union has opened a new chapter in Turkey's membership talks. This chapter is on budget contributions to the bloc. This is the 16th chapter to be opened with Turkey out of a total of 35, and there are still five chapters blocked because of a dispute between Ankara and the government of Cyprus. So although there seems to be progress after long stall talks, there's still plenty of road ahead of Turkey's EU membership.
And how has the migrant issue played into the possibility of Turkey joining the European Union? The idea that the EU has recently made this deal with Turkey that involves sending undocumented migrants or illegal migrants back to Turkey, but at the same time, the idea that a full European Union membership comes with the free movement of people.
Well, the migrant issue has started to play a significant role recently as Turkey started to use this issue as leverage against the EU. The accession talks, as I said, were previously stalled until very recently. But in March this year, there was a deal struck with Brussels, the deal that you mentioned, that demanded when Turkey demanded progress on its EU bid in return for taking back in migrants who wanted to seek asylum in Europe. Well, Turkey was also promised visa-free travel to the EU's Schengen area if it complied with a series of demands, like, for instance, changing its terror legislation or preventing corruption, etc. And the negotiations with the EU have started moving on. So it looks like the migrant deal is working for Turkey at the moment. But will it work to the extent of lifting the visa restrictions against Turkish citizens? Well, that is still unclear.
And of course, there are some European countries that do not want Turkey to join the European Union. What kind of opposition does Turkey face in its bid?
There are concerns in the European Union about the possibility of a future influx of Turkish workers predominantly. Turkey is a secular country with a predominant Muslim population. So that is a concern amongst many European countries, saying that this could actually change the character of the bloc. The possibility of Turkey joining the European Union has caused concern in many countries like France, Netherlands, Austria, Germany in years. And very recently, Turkey's bid has, we have seen, caused concern in the UK as well. That played a very prominent part during the UK's European Union referendum campaign. The Leave campaign warned that the EU was preparing to let Turkey in. They were saying 12 million Turks would be on their way soon. Of course, that was far from reality because there are still many years ahead of Turkey's probable accession to the European Union. Once British Prime Minister David Cameron has said it would take probably 3,000 years for Turkey to join the European Union. Well, that might be a bit of an exaggeration, but still, Turkey is nowhere near.
And of course, right now, Turkey is still reeling from the terrorist attack at the airport where you are in Istanbul. Last week, more than 40 people killed. And of course, we've seen a number of terrorist attacks in Turkey over the last year or so. What role does that play as people are so focused right now on security?
I don't think there would be an organic link between these two unless we're talking about enhancing cooperation against terror between Turkey and the European Union. After the Istanbul airport attack, that's what actually the Turkish president has called for. He said this could be a major turning point for enhanced cooperation. In the last year alone, Turkey has seen 8 major suicide bombings and car bombings, and these killed nearly 300 people. So, of course, the fact that such attacks take place in Turkey does not help the portrayal, the image of the country. The tourism figures have already dropped by 40%. But if we're talking about Turkey's EU bid, does this attack harm that bid? Well, probably they shouldn't have such an effect, because terror attacks have hit European capitals as well, cities like Brussels and Paris recently too. So Europe already knows how it feels, and there is that empathy felt towards Turkey's recent pain as well. But enhanced cooperation between intelligence services, between security forces, that seems as something necessary and something Ankara would be pushing for.
That's the BBC's Ceylan Girit speaking with us from Istanbul. Ceylan, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Well, on this Independence Day, 7,000 men and women will become U.S. citizens at nearly 100 ceremonies across the country. People who have been drawn to the United States, the land of opportunity, where hard work can lead to success. Especially if you have a patent for your idea. In the earliest days of the U.S. patent system, inventors were required to submit not only a sketch and description of their concept, but also a toy-like model that was kept on file. And as Todd Bookman of Here and Now contributor WHYY and The Pulse reports, many of those patent models survive today.
Deborah Hughes knows a ton about patent models. Her home base is the Hagley Museum and Library, located in Wilmington, Delaware, along the banks of the Brandywine River. The Hagley, after receiving a big donation earlier this year, now has close to 5,000 models in its collection. But that's still just a small sampling of the roughly 200,000 the U.S. Patent Office received between 1790 and 1880.
They represent the brilliant minds of Americans in the 1800s and these great ideas they had on a multitude of perceived problems, and everything from toys to furniture to medical to sports to everything.
Yeah, everything you could think of is captured in model form. The mason jar, different kinds of locks and keys, a lifeboat, roller skates, tons of different mouse traps, all no bigger than 12 inches by 12 inches by 12 inches. Some are made of wood, some of different metals and fabrics. They have moving parts, tiny gears, dovetail joints. They're honestly fascinating.
Why do you think we're so drawn to them?
I think it's the miniature and the toy look of them, and frankly, some of them are pretty stinking cute.
The patent models were big hits a century ago, too. The U.S. Patent Office would put models out on display for the public to see. It was like the Consumer Electronics Show or some other trade event where the inventions of the future were unveiled and debated. In sifting through the Hagley's collection, visitors can see industry's hopes for the future. There's all manner of different machines and tools and engines. But there are also more practical improvements meant to solve the challenges of the day.
During this time period, most of these would have been aimed for soldiers from the Civil War.
Deborah Hughes is pointing to a miniature artificial leg, cast in brass with joints at the ankle and knee. Leather straps would be used to attach it to the thigh. It's one of the many prosthetic devices patented in the 1860s.
Before the Civil War, it was basically your carved peg leg, which is what you would have had. So this is a big improvement.
There were lots of products, both hits and misses, geared toward the domestic tasks of women of that time. Though there is a notable lack of contributions from women. Just a tiny fraction can be traced to female inventors. Though Hughes says that stat shortchanges their role.
The record is spotty with women invention, and a number of years ago, they pulled together a list of women inventors. But the hardest part about that is that sometimes women invented under like an initial and a last name, because they didn't want it to look like they were a woman.
A complete record of inventors and their models was hampered by major fires that ripped through the patent offices in 1836 and then again in 1877. By 1880, Congress dropped the model requirement, in part because it was just becoming a logistical nightmare to store and catalog them.
They basically ran out of space.
Alan Rothschild is a retired pharmacist from outside of Syracuse, New York. After Congress donated some of the more notable models to the Smithsonian, it put the rest up for auction. Over the past 90 years or so, they've been bought and sold, and Rothschild, sort of unexpectedly, wound up assembling the country's largest private collection.
So when I found these models, I was fascinated by them, and I bought a few, and then I bought a few more, and then I bought a whole lot more.
Earlier this year, Rothschild chose the Hagley Museum as the recipient for his 4,000-plus models, where they're being cataloged and readied for display. To him, they represent the heart of the American economy.
The patent system is what spawned the Industrial Revolution in this country. I mean, there's absolutely, I don't think anybody will deny that. There is no question about it. This is what made the country successful.
Rothschild also makes the case that the models are still relevant today, that every app, pharmaceutical, or silicon-based breakthrough is really just an improvement on the technology that came before it. For Here and Now, I'm Todd Bookman.
Across the country today, there are parades, road races, fireworks, and musical performances, including from our next guest. Emily Sunshine Hamilton, who goes by Emmy Sunshine, is performing in Etowah, Tennessee at the old-fashioned 4th of July celebration. She is just 12 years old. She's a singer-songwriter. She's been on national television. Her YouTube videos have millions of hits. Her band, The Rain, includes her dad on bass, her brother on mandolin, and her uncle on drums. Her mom co-writes her songs. We spoke with her last November when she was 11, and we asked her to play us something.
Sure. It's called Mama's Girl. My mom lost her mom a few years ago, and I think it's more about my grandmother. My mom used to love to go hear her songs and hear her write songs, really, and I think that's one of the reasons she started writing, too. I want to go back when I was 10, walk through that George sand.
Thank you. That was fantastic. And it shows so many different things just listening to you do that. First of all, you have a beautiful voice.
Thank you.
But also just so talented, and you're 11 years old.
Yes, I am. Yeah.
How do you think your age affects your music?
Well, I'm not really sure. I just really love to sing all the time. I'm not really affected by it very much.
Well, a lot of people say that you have an old soul.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Well, my mom has always told me that when I was little, too, so people started telling me that was pretty cool, so I don't...
Do you think you have an old soul?
I think I do sometimes, yeah. My songs,
why?
What I write. I don't really write, I write these songs about how people die and how people get sick, and I write all about this kind of stuff, and it's always just come naturally to write that kind of music.
It's interesting because you call yourself Emmy Sunshine, and yet you're taking on some pretty deep, serious topics.
Yeah. Well, my mom was going to name me Maggie, but she decided to call me Emily Sunshine Hamilton. When I was little, I couldn't say Emily, so I just started calling myself Emmy.
Hmm. So you started so young. You were writing songs when you were 5, I think is what I've read
yes.
about you.
Yeah, about 5 or 6. You were
5 or 6, and you recorded your first album at 7. How did you get into all of that in the first place?
Well, that is a long story. My mom's always written for all of her life, but my dad, she was a singer in a gospel group. So I've had a lot of musical history.
Now, many people have compared you to Taylor Swift, who started also very young, but then she's sort of moved into more of a pop sound. Are you worried that there's going to be pressure on you to do that, to change your sound?
Well, actually, I'm not going to change my sound at all. I don't want to change to anything pop country or anything like that. So,
why not?
Because it's not who I am, and I just don't feel like the music is really, it ain't real anymore to me at all.
Pop music is not real to you?
No.
But country is?
Well, the older country.
Make the distinction for people who don't, you know, listen to a lot of country music. What do you mean by that? What's the difference between the older country and the newer country?
Well, Johnny Cash and June Carter and Dolly Parton, all those people are real country. And the people that they're showing now, to me, it's more pop than it is country anymore.
Well, let's hear another one of your songs. I know you've got another one in mind.
Oh, yeah. Late one night, I snuck off when no one else could see. I couldn't help myself. It was someone else's voice that was calling me. He said, step right in and I'll show you where this country folks call home. I said, little girl, do you want to go sing in that hollowed room? Old Marty Stewart fancied up my room after the big old flood. Well, I guess it was a collaboration, but let's just keep that between us. Sit down in this red leather chair, run your fingers through the fringe. Kick up your boots, sing me green grass upon me, and you are gonna be good friends. I want a dress that's for the wagon blue. I want wagon wheels, cactus stems, and rhinestones on my boots. I want to stand in the circle of that hollow room filled with spirits gathered around me. I want to share all my stories, sing all my songs in a dress that's Porter Wagoner blue.
That was great. Thank you very much. And as I'm hearing that, I'm wondering also, what's been the most difficult thing for you about being a kid, 11 years old, and even before that, and having to live the life of a performer?
Well, I do get to do kid stuff, too. And I do my homework. I'm just like any other regular kid, only I go on the road.
And you're still able to do your schoolwork and hang out with friends?
Yes, I'm homeschooled.
But in terms of hanging out with friends, how do you manage to do that?
Well, usually they go on the road with me sometimes.
That must be pretty fun for them. And you.
Oh, yeah, it's a lot of fun. Mostly in the summer they get to.
How important has YouTube been for you to get your songs out there?
Well, ever since I was little, I always put my stuff on YouTube. I never really thought it would go off like it did. Somebody in the crowd at a flea market that we were playing at, they recorded it and put it on YouTube. And it started getting a bunch of hits, they asked us to fly down to New York to do the Today Show. And we got invited to the Ryman Auditorium, and that's how we got on the Grand Ole Opry after that.
which is the dream of many musicians, just to perform at the Grand Ole Opry. What about now? What's next? I mean, what do you want to do now that you've accomplished that?
Well, I told my mom I want to go to China. I just like to go to different places. It's a lot of fun to go places you've never been before. They have a big country music festival there, too.
So as people are listening to your music, Emmy Sunshine, what do you want to make sure that they're hearing in it?
Well, what I want them to make sure they're hearing in it is the story of it. Just like the Porter Wagoner Blues song, that is a story song, and I really love that song. I want my story songs to be heard. I don't want them to be just my voice, you know?
Emmy Sunshine, 11 years old, of the band Emmy Sunshine and the Rain. Thank you so much for joining us and for playing some of your music for us, too.
Oh, you're welcome.
And as we close out this segment, Emmy, why don't you play us one more song?
That'd be great.
Emily Sunshine Hamilton, a.k.a. Emmy Sunshine, speaking with us and singing for us last year. It's Here and Now. Tributes continue to pour in following the death of Elie Wiesel, the Nobel Peace Prize-winning writer who survived the Nazi death camps that claimed his father, his mother, and his younger sister. And after that experience, he spent the rest of his life delivering a simple message: never forget. Well, we want to take a few minutes to remember Wiesel now in his own words. In 2009, Wiesel went to Buchenwald with President Obama and German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and there he recalled the death of his father.
He called my name, and I was too afraid to move. All of us were. And when he died, I was there, but I was not there.
After the liberation of Buchenwald in April of 1945, Wiesel spent a few years in a French orphanage, then landed in Paris, where he studied literature and philosophy at the Sorbonne. He became a journalist, writing for French and Israeli newspapers. He wrote more than 40 books, but his most influential work was Night, a classic in the category of the Diary of Anne Frank as a document of the Holocaust. In one haunting passage, he wrote about arriving at Auschwitz. "Never shall I forget that smoke. Never shall I forget the little faces of the children whose bodies I saw turned into wreaths of smoke beneath a silent blue sky. Never shall I forget these things, even if I am condemned to live as long as God himself. Never." Elie Wiesel received countless honors during his lifetime, including the Nobel Peace Prize in 1986. Here is part of his acceptance speech.
"One person of integrity, of courage, can make a difference of life and death. And therefore I know that as long as one dissident is in prison, our freedom will not be true. As long as one child is hungry, our lives will be filled with anguish and shame, for I have seen children hungry. What all these victims need, above all, is to know that they are not alone, that we are not forgetting them, that when their voices are stifled, we shall lend them ours. That while their freedom depends on ours, the quality of our freedom depends on theirs.
Elie Wiesel accepting the Nobel Peace Prize in 1986. I had the good fortune of taking Elie Wiesel's class when I was a student at Boston University, where he taught for nearly 40 years. In the class, we read a different book each week about a different religion and spent the class time discussing it with Wiesel. One week, he had to miss class because he was chairing an international conference in Europe. So he asked the author of the book we were reading to teach the class that week in his stead. Another day, a fellow student asked Wiesel if he had ever thought about giving up on Judaism, given the terrible things that had happened to him. And he told us about a moment in the concentration camp when he and the other children held a trial for God and found God guilty. He said he never lost his faith, however. You're listening to Here and Now. The markets in the U.S. are closed today for the holiday after a roller coaster of a week. The Dow dropped about 900 points after the Brexit vote and has gained almost all of it back. So, what to do with your money? Jill Schlesinger is a business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Jill, happy 4th of July. Welcome.
Thank you. Happy Independence Day to you as well.
Well, and even though the markets are closed, obviously a lot going on around the world in the markets right now. What are the biggest questions you've been hearing from people this summer about what they should be doing with their money?
I think the most frequently asked questions are really along the lines of, like, how does this impact me? And, you know, it impacts us in different ways, and the story is still evolving. But I think theoretically, what should happen, and it may not, is that markets are going to be pretty choppy regardless of recovering ground. We could probably see a more downside action. Looks like interest rates are going to remain lower for longer. And, you know, if you are traveling, obviously it's good news. If you're heading over to London, your dollar goes a bit farther than it would have. If you're home and you like to import beautiful French cheese and Italian wine, that's also good. I think the only downside here that is pretty significant, though, is that with a strong U.S. dollar, that's not very good for U.S. manufacturers and exporters. So if you work for one of those big companies, you might be a little bit under pressure here. So it's going to be okay. Try not to do anything sudden. That's the most important thing.
So what should you do? What's your advice for people as they look ahead to all of this going on around the world?
I think that, you know, we've just come off the end of a quarter, and surprisingly, people still don't rebalance their portfolios every single quarter, which I think they should do. I think that's just easy to do because you can choose something called auto-rebalancing. It just makes sure your allocation remains in check, and it kind of keeps you away from messing with your retirement assets at the wrong time. I mean, think about this. Let's just presume that on the Friday morning after the Brexit vote, you got freaked out and you sold. Then you miss
big mistake.
The whole big mistake. Right now it may end up being the right move because who knows, maybe things will go down. But what we know over time is that market timing is really hard to execute. You've got to make two perfect decisions, when to sell, when to buy back in, and nobody does it. So I think right now from your investment portfolio, just rebalance. Make sure that your allocation is in line with your real risk tolerance. You know, if you were freaking out on that Friday, you probably came in with too much risk. Good news is that the market just kind of rewarded you for not doing anything, and now you can adjust your risk horizon, how much time you have before you need your money. And by the way, if you need any money within the next year, you should not have it in a risky asset. So get out of that risky asset, push it aside. It's going to earn basically paltry 0%-ish kind of interest. Who cares? You've got to protect it.
Okay, we're talking here about what you should do with the money you have. What about the money that you don't have? What should people who have debt be doing right now?
You know, I think that it's so hard to manage your debt unless you're really tracking how you're spending your money. So every single conversation about financial planning begins with this annoying task, which is track your money. It used to be so much harder. It's really easy now, actually. You got easy to use apps, Mint, Digit, Level Money. You've just got to get a handle on what's coming in and what's going out. Once you have that, then you're just basically looking at your list of debt. You start with the highest interest first, and you start whittling it down. If you have both consumer debt, meaning credit cards and maybe an auto loan, as well as student debt, I would prioritize the consumer loans first because they're usually higher interest. And again, once you've paid one debt down, take the money you were paying towards that debt and just shift to the next highest interest debt after that.
Jill, you've got some advice about home and auto insurance. What's that?
Well, first of all, isn't that the most exciting thing to talk about?
For the 4th of July. You know, forget about the hot dogs and the hamburgers. Let's talk about home and auto insurance.
Well, I am talking to you, and you are in the Northeast. And normally what happens is that towards the end of the summer, we start talking about hurricane season, and some horrible storm hits, and nobody understands what's going on in their homeowner's or renter's policy. So how about before something bad happens that we all look at these policies? And the reason I say that is I think many people would be surprised that if you look at your policy, you might say, wait a minute, I'm insuring a house that actually is worth more than my insurance says. So some of this has to do with rising house prices. So you want to make sure that your policy reflects that. It's very easy to actually shop for homeowners and renters insurance, but you have to actually do it. It doesn't happen automatically. And you want to compare apples to apples before you start switching policy. So just understand what you have. And you look, for auto insurance, if you've got an old clunker car and it's worth less than $5,000, obviously there are some ways that you can make your money go farther because you just eliminate your collision and comprehensive coverage and you increase your deductible. So, and I'm a big fan, by the way, of liability insurance, just general umbrella liability insurance. You tack it on to either your home or your auto policy. It's very cheap and it's unlikely you'll ever need it. And if you do, you'll be happy you have it.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. And we'll put some of these tips up at our website, hereandnow.org. Jill, thanks so much and happy 4th of July.
And happy to you as well.
Well, this is a very busy day for Zach Tamanosian. He is a show designer and operations manager at Zambelli Fireworks, a family-owned company based in Newcastle, Pennsylvania. The company's been around since the late 1800s, and it's a global player in delivering splashy fireworks shows. Zach, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So what are people going to be noticing that's different this year about fireworks of the past in terms of the technology behind it?
Every year the technology gets a little better. One of the most noticeable differences is in the firing equipment, the computer firing technology that fires the shells to exact timing. Every year it gets a little bit better. Every year there's new features. In addition, each year the effects change a little bit. It keeps up with the industry and you see different colors, different effects each year.
But as our iPhones get better, as our computers get better, is the fireworks technology getting better at that speed?
It doesn't move quite at that speed. We don't have those kind of dollars and figures behind the equipment going into this industry, but it certainly does progress every year.
And does every town in America have the latest stuff, or is it really just the most high profile and big cities and rich communities that can afford this latest technology, and some are still using the old stuff?
It certainly is dependent upon the budget. There are so many shows on July 4th that many of them are not computer fired. It is a premium service when we do a computer fired display, and that plays into your budget.
What are the challenges for you with one of these high tech displays?
Well, when you mix electronics with explosives, you're always going to run into issues. You know, 99% of the time, everything is fine, but we're putting sensitive electronics out into, you know, harsh environments usually, open fields, rain, weather. That's usually our biggest problem is harsh weather can really cause some of the more significant issues. But if you are careful and diligent in your duties, you can usually mitigate those type of situations by sort of, you know, planning ahead is really the main thing that makes us successful.
How did you get into this business? And is it still exciting to see fireworks displays when you've been doing it for so long?
Absolutely. I'm excited every day to go to work. I'm excited every time I see a show, even if it's not ours. I love it. It is my passion. It started long ago as I can remember. I was lucky enough to have a father who taught me the safe way to use fireworks, and that literally ignited a passion in me. Years down the road, he got me hooked up with a local parade from my hometown, which culminates in a fireworks display. And it happened to be Zambelli Fireworks who produced that display. And from the time I stepped on the site, I was hooked. And it blossomed from there. I shot shows part-time through college, and eventually everything worked out where I was able to acquire a full-time position with Zambelli Fireworks and have been doing it and loving it ever since.
I would tell you my favorite kind of firework, but I don't even know how I would describe it.
Okay. Well, you can try, and I'll try to
It's actually just white, but it sort of has these long trails of sort of sparkle that come down after the – with each little flame. Can you
sure.
think
so
of what I'm explaining?
Typically is known as a kimura or a weeping willow.
That makes sense.
More than likely, sometimes a brocade. A lot of these effects have multiple different names depending on the manufacturer, but more than likely that is a white kimura with kimura tail shell.
More of those, please.
Those seem to be a crowd favorite. And along with the pattern shells, people seem to really – we hear the biggest reaction out of the smiley faces and hearts
right.
a lot of times.
Well, Zach Tamanosian, show designer and operations manager at Zambelli Fireworks, thanks so much and happy 4th of July.
Thank you, Jeremy. Same to you.
News on this 4th of July that NBA star Kevin Durant of the Oklahoma City Thunder will sign with the Golden State Warriors. Durant has been with the same franchise for his entire career, so this was a surprise to many, and we will watch the reaction to it. But it's another example of the rules of the business of the NBA, which, along with those of the NFL, feel to The Atlantic's Derek Thompson more socialist than capitalist. Hi, Derek, and happy 4th of July.
Happy 4th of July, Jeremy.
So, as we celebrate America's birthday, you say the NFL and the NBA would please a Scandinavian social democrat. Explain.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, America prides itself on capitalism, but you look at its most famous diversion, American sports. There are salary caps. There are luxury taxes. There is revenue sharing between rich teams and poor teams. If you're a loser in the NFL or the NBA, you are rewarded, in fact. Success is, as I said, punished by design, and misfortune is rewarded because they get high draft picks. So the best young players go to the worst teams. This is all an attempt, essentially, to make sure that no one team gets too much more successful over too long a period than another team. And it seems to me that that is exactly the kind of social democratic model that a lot of conservatives hate and liberals love up in Northern Europe and Scandinavia.
And yet you say that European soccer teams are not run this way.
And here is the great irony, is that you go to the socialist hotbed of Europe, and it turns out that their sports are more capitalist, and they have practices that would please an American conservative. They don't have salary cap rules, so it turns out that there are a handful of rich teams that just win and win and win. When a soccer team in England performs poorly, they're not rewarded with the best young player. In fact, they're relegated to a lower league. So the most successful teams are rewarded. The bad teams are punished. It seems like a very kind of free market American capitalist solution to sports leagues in Europe.
Do you have a sense of why we have that ironic situation?
Well, so I wanted to go back and look at history. You know, why did the system of promotion and relegation start in England? It started in the 19th century, where you have thousands of these new soccer clubs, and they're playing each other in sort of like an ad hoc scheduling process. And they decide to create a new football league, and the league only has 12 teams. And so if you have a league of 12 teams in a system of 1,000 teams, and so if a team wasn't very good, they would kick them out and bring one of the 1,000 back on to the league. In the U.S., though, you just don't have this problem of abundance. There are only 32 teams in the NFL. If one of them is really, really bad, there's no 33rd team that's almost as good as, say, the Tennessee Titans. And so both of these systems, both the sort of the so-called capitalist system in Europe and the so-called socialist system in American sports, are both answers to the same question. And that question is, what's the best way to treat the worst teams in our league? What's the best way to keep fans interested in the worst teams in our league?
Which do you think produces a better game?
I actually think that, I should probably say this on July 4th, in fact, I do think that America is number one in this case. You look at the just absolutely tremendous success of the NFL and the NBA in growing fans, both in the U.S. And abroad. This tremendous capacity to build drama in the league because no one team builds a dynasty for too long. I do, in this case, think that America gets it right.
The other interesting thing here is that at the core, the rules may be socialist in the American leagues, but they're all about making money. I have never seen anything more capitalistic than, you know, a major league sporting event.
No, that is exactly right. I do think, as I said in the conclusion of the piece, that to ensure the widespread popularity of their sports, each of these leagues, the NFL, the NBA, Major League Baseball, they have made parody their cardinal virtue. And to make sure that every single market is relatively equally served and these fans keep watching year after year after year, that encouraged them to embrace a variety of socialism that most other American institutions have absolutely rejected. I do find that a beautiful irony. And judging by the profits earned by the NFL, it seems, at least in sports, that being nice to losers has been a winning strategy.
You know, the sport that I always used to play on the 4th of July was the watermelon toss at the local swimming pool back in Illinois, where they would throw like a greased up watermelon in the pool. And then we would all jump in. And I think one of us had to like actually be able to hold on to it and move it to the side. The coin toss, also fun and very capitalist. Throw a ton of quarters into the pool and whoever can pick up the most wins.
What a beautiful metaphor for the U.S. economy.
Yeah, exactly. Your favorite 4th of July memories, Derek, while we have you on this Independence Day?
Oh, gosh. I think just eating hot dogs while watching Joey Chestnut eat 50 times more than me.
Well, enjoy the hot dog, Derek, on this 4th of July. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.